it is a special tribute when the director of this centre raises himself from his deathbed imposed by the horrible flu in order to introduce a speaker. But in this case, Olivier de Fourville is a very close friend of the centre, and he is somebody who has to be very grateful to the centre, because since he arrived here, he has published his major study on international criminal law to great acclaim already. He has been promoted to the professorship in public law in the University of Paris II, which is a great achievement. And to crown it all, he is appearing in the concluding Friday lunchtime lecture of this year. So I think so much honor bestowed upon one person is noteworthy indeed. As you know, Olivier at present still is professor in Montpellier. He is a member of the UN Working Group and on enforced or involuntary disappearances, which is a very important mandate. And we are all aware how one single individual can make a real difference to the lives of people who find themselves in desperate situations. So it is a very responsible position he is exercising. He is an expert in public law with an emphasis on human rights law and international crimes. But he is also a theoretician of note. He has worked a lot on democracy in international law. He will now be talking to us about humanitarian interventions, so-called, in the context of cosmopolitan theories. As you all know, international law has not yet quite been able to explain why humanitarian intervention may be not only legitimate, but possibly lawful. The traditional ways in which we would account for a change in the law on the prohibition of the use of force, a use Hogan's type rule, do not quite allow us to explain it, if indeed we believe that this new or recently emerged rule does exist. So let us see whether Olivier offers us an alternative that will persuade. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much first for the very kind words. And as this is recorded, I would like to take this opportunity to make a bit of advertisement for the center, and with most of it to thank you very much, Mark, and through you all the staff of the center for the wonderful time I'm spending here in Cambridge. It's not finished yet, so I'm still speaking in the present tense. It's a very stimulating environment and getting a lot from it. And as you said, the first accomplishment was this book in international criminal law, and I'm currently preparing the next book, which would be a book on theory of international law. And obviously this lecture is a kind of test for me. I'm testing some ideas. I'm very keen to see your reactions and comments at the end. It probably didn't go unnoticed for you that in France we have a new president, and for the first speech after his election, François Hollande spoke about the return of the French dream. So I don't know if my lecture will be reflective of this French dream, but at least I hope I can make you dream about the future of international law. I hope that this dream will be an awakened dream, and I will not get you asleep before the end of the lecture. That's my main challenge today. But my insistence for that is that I think that, well, maybe you will have the impression that this is a discussion about words, about theories, and this is very abstract and very far from the reality. Well, I would argue that theories and words matter, and that it's very important to discuss about theories, and I would like to take up the words of Philippe Allot, which I have the opportunity and the honor to meet here in Cambridge, which says, reality is not what it is, but what it is conceived to be. And I think this is a very important idea, and I'm very and full convergence with the with this statement. So what is the purpose of this lecture today? It starts from a question, which is about the links or the filiation between the responsibility to protect and the cosmopolitan theory. Is there a link in between those two paradigms? When I speak about the responsibility to protect, I think I don't need to specify before such a knowledgeable assembly what it is. I'm mainly referring to the Atkan document of the General Assembly, the 2005 summit of the General Assembly, but also to the more thorough document which had been produced before by the Commission on the Intervention and the Sovereignty of States. So basically, the references for me to speak about the responsibility to protect. So are there any links between this responsibility to protect, as it has been recently forged, and the cosmopolitan theory? If we look at it at first sight, we may answer yes. Obviously, there is a clear link, and those authors which avail themselves from the cosmopolitan philosophy would in general defend humanitarian intervention, the idea that some states or the international community can intervene militarily to defend victimized civilians by their governments, people who have been victimized, who have been subject to mass crimes. For instance, just to mention one author, if we think about Jürgen Habermas, which I think we can classify as both a Kantian and a cosmopolitan author, he defended very vehemently the intervention in 1999 against Serbia in Kosovo, to defend the people of Kosovo. Well, so that's the first impression we can get. Now, what I want to try to do here is to go further, and I would like to show that this link is not so obvious. And in fact, what I would like to do in the first part of this lecture is to show that not only this R2P, as it is, as it has been conceived in recent times, is R2P is the contraction for responsibility to protect, is a foreign to the cosmopolitan theory, but also I think is probably a theory which would lead us to something which we don't want, which probably would not be so safe and so clear conception or conceptualization of humanitarian intervention. So that will be my first part, to try to analyze the foundations of the R2P and to show that it's not automatically linked to the cosmopolitan theory, and in fact that it's foreign to the cosmopolitan theory. What I will try to do then in the second part is to try to rebuild, rebuild what could be a sound cosmopolitan theory of humanitarian intervention on the basis of the cosmopolitan philosophy. So let's start by analyzing the foundations of this responsibility to protect. Well, I would say first, I think it's a patchwork of doctrines. I don't think it is a very coherent concept. To my view, it is composed, or it is a kind of patchwork of two doctrines, of two main ideas, the one being the idea of protection and the other being the idea of functional sovereignty. Let me explain those two ideas. The first is protection. Protection of the lives of people, protection of the security of civilians. That's mainly what the R2P is about, protecting the bodies, the people in their life and in their inherent and basic needs for a decent life. I submit that this is closely linked, but I don't have the time to developed that to the concept of human security, which has been developed in the 90s and which appeared as a banner for the foreign policy of Canada for some times. And you have to remember that Canada pushed for the creation of the Commission on Intervention and Sovereignty of State. So there, I think that there is a very clear link in between those two concepts. What I would like to say here is that this concept of protection of life, of the body of the person, is totally foreign to the Kantian philosophy and to the cosmopolitan philosophy, which I think is much more about the protection of rights. Kant's philosophy is about, and Kant's definition of law is about, how do you reconcile the freedoms of all by imposing some coercion, some limits to the freedoms of all? How do you reconcile those freedoms? How do you manage the state in order that all the rights of all the people be reconciled? So Kant's theory of law is not about protecting life, it's about protecting the right to life. It's not about protecting properties, but about protecting the rights of persons to possess and secure their properties. Thus, if there has to be a military intervention in a foreign country under a cosmopolitan model, it should not aim at the survival of the population or the protection of life of those people, but at the protection of human rights, or if you prefer, it should aim at stopping the perpetration of crimes which have a massive impact on human rights. This is not only a rhetorical change, but it's a difference of paradigm. If we are to try to understand this notion of protection under a particular philosophy, I think we should better turn to Hobbes rather than Kant. Hobbes' philosophy is really about protection. What the people are looking for by giving up their rights to the Leviathan is security, is precisely protection. And what motivates that giving up of rights is the fear for their lives. And Hobbes defines the sovereign or the Leviathan as the one, I quote, which is able to defend them from the invasion of foreigners and the injuries of one another. It sounds a bit like Marine Le Pen, don't you think? And conversely, the subjects have an absolute duty to obey the sovereign. But this absolute duty ends where protection ends. And this is very clearly stated in the Leviathan, which I quote again. The obligation of subjects to the sovereign is understood to last as long and no longer than the power lasts, by which he is able to protect them. For the rights men have by nature to protect themselves when no one else can protect them, and by no covenant be relinquished. So the true father of the R2P would thus be Hobbes, and not Kant. If we accept this starting point, we also have to take into account the critics which have been addressed to the R2P on this basis. There are mainly two critical range of arguments which I would like to summarize here briefly. A first range of critics would say that the R2P, in focusing on the protection of life, is setting aside the concern for rights. So in a way, security under a very Hobbesian framework, security is bargained against rights and offered as very, I think, convincing words to explain that when she shows that there has been a shift with the R2P from the idea of authority grounded on rights to an authority grounded on effective protection. And she takes the example of the Human Rights Court's judgment in Behrami and Sarasmati to show how the fact that the military operation was led in the name of humanity in a way immunized it from any accusation of violation of human rights. Going a bit further, another range of arguments that avails itself from Michel Foucault would insist that the protection of lives and not of rights means the birth at the global level of a kind of biopower, which itself would be the logical consequence of the expansion of the capitalist rule. The R2P would thus express a disciplinary power against states in order to manage life properly. And Georgia Agamben has led the accusation with lots of convincing words by showing that such kinds of intervention which create bare life, that is life without rights on the pretext of protecting life, are a danger for rights. So protection, I think, should be set aside if we try to build a cosmopolitan theory of intervention, of humanitarian intervention. What is now about the second concept, which is functional sovereignty? What means functional sovereignty? It means that sovereignty is conditioned to the fulfillment of certain given functions. Such a concept has been very well described in an old article, 1910, published in the Revue Générale de Droit International Public, by Antoine Rougier, which is called The Theory of Intervention d'Humanité. Very interesting article. I really invite you to consult it in this library. What Antoine Rougier is saying is that the concept of functional sovereignty means that the sovereign can only use public force to implement some precise functions. Two functions are identified by Rougier: maintaining a regular government and protecting the human rights of people. The consequence is very clear in the words of Rougier. When a state uses its force outside the functions of sovereignty, it commits what Rougier calls a deviation of sovereignty, a diversion. I don't know what is exactly the translation, détournement de souveraineté. Having committed such a diversion, the state is to be put under international control. That is to say that its sovereignty is to be substituted by the sovereignty of another state or a group of states. If you think about it a second, it's easy to see that this mechanism has a lot of similarities with the R2P, where the R2P says that there is a sovereignty as a responsibility means nothing else than a functional sovereignty. Sovereignty is conditioned by the fulfillment of the function of protection. And when the state fails to fulfill that function, then the international community is to take over, that is to say, to take control over the state, substitute itself to the state in the fulfillment of this protective function. Now, why do I think that this notion of functional sovereignty is a problem to build a cosmopolitan theory? I think the problem is twice. This notion is both aporetic and it is also dangerous, practically. It is first aporetic because I think that if you believe in sovereignty, or sovereignty being a principle of international law, which is not my case, but I won't discuss that for the moment, I think it would only complicate the discussion. If you believe that sovereignty means something, you believe that sovereignty means freedom, basically. That's one meaning of sovereignty. Sovereignty is a kind of transposition of the natural freedom of the individual, and the state is thought as a kind of natural person, even though it's not a natural person, but that's the doctrine of sovereignty. And there cannot be any natural person whose freedom is assigned some functions. We only assign functions to artificial objects, like international organizations, for instance, that are driven by a principle of speciality and that are limited to fulfilling their function. You cannot only conceptualize a freedom which is functional, that cannot exist. So it's an aporia. The second thing, and I think which is probably the most important thing, is that functional sovereignty is dangerous. Sovereignty also means, doesn't only mean freedom, it also means self-determination. It also means independence from foreign intervention. It also means the right of the people to give themselves their own government without any foreign intervention. The major risk of the R2P, as it is conceptualized, is that it allows to decide whether a state should remain independent or not. And the most worrying thing is that this decision pertains to a body which is the Security Council, whom we know takes a decision in a total arbitrary manner, I would say discretionary manner, to be more moderate. So basically, what the R2P means is that the Security Council can decide to deprive a state and the people of its independence and to submit it to an international control. Here again, I think that the criticisms addressed by the postmodern philosophers are far reaching. So again, I would propose to set aside this idea of functional sovereignty, and with this, I would propose that the notion of the responsibility to protect is not the right concept. We need to theorize humanitarian intervention. So now let me try to rebuild that proposal and that theory of intervention under or through a cosmopolitan perspective. I have to say a few words before on the general framework of the cosmopolitan theory. Before explaining the central concept, which I think can help us, which is federal execution. I would summarize very briefly, you know, the thinking of Kant about this. It's a broad simplification, I'm sorry for that. Of course, I don't have time. You know very well the story. All the people are in the state of nature. They have natural rights, but unfortunately, they cannot enforce those rights. And they cannot secure those rights. They are in a state of insecurity because there is no central government or there is no force, more generally force of coercion, that would impose some limits to the freedom of all so that the freedom of each and everyone can be respected. So what the people would do would be to decide to institute a commonwealth whereby a central force, a power of coercion, can impose some limits to the freedoms of all so that the freedoms of each and everyone can be respected. But the problem, says Kant, it's not the end of it, says Kant, because the state of war against of all against all, continues to prevail at the international level. The nations are continuing to make war to each other, and the state of insecurity continues because of that war. So the states themselves have to also fund a commonwealth of nations. Kant is wondering what could be the best institution, and he contemplates the possibility of a world state, which he rejects. Why? Because it won't be manageable, because it will be a world tyranny. And he proposes instead a concept which I think is very useful, which is central to my reflection, which is the Federation of Free States. Federation of Free States, it means, it may seem a bit mysterious. If you have a federation, only the federation is sovereign, but not the member states. So how can there be a Federation of Free States? It seems to be a poetic again. My submission here is that what Kant means is not that the Federation of Free States is a static notion. It's about a process. It's about a process from going to the natural state, the state of nature, to the civil state at the international level. And this passage results from a dialectic between two conflicting imperatives, the imperative of freedom and the imperative of coercion. States have to remain free, so that freedom of individuals is to be preserved and protected against foreign intervention. At the same time, there can be no freedom without a certain degree of coercion. So So building a cosmopolitan perspective means finding at each and every moment a balance between freedom and coercion. If the theory of free states is the central notion which I would like to use, the federation of free states as a process, and not to be taken at a certain moment in time, not to say that there is today a federation of free states that is existing, because that, anyway, that would be a contradiction in terms, but that there is a process ongoing to build a federation of free states. If this is the central concept, then we have to use the tools of the theory of federation to try to explain and to try to describe what we see in the reality today. And in particular, to try to explain the phenomenon of humanitarian intervention. One tool which I would like to put forward here is the tool of federal execution. So it doesn't mean, that's the translation from the French, it doesn't mean capital punishment. No? Because I say that because then when I try to Googleize the federal execution, that's the only thing I got. Somebody's been executed, federal execution in, etc. No. This is really an expression, this is a notion which is part of the theory of the federation, is something which is discussed in the manuals, where there are some reflections, few manuals where there are some reflections about how a federation, including the United States, for instance, do work. The crucial question to which this notion is trying to give an answer is the following. How can possibly independence and self-determination be preserved while accepting the principle of military intervention? We have seen that, in my opinion, the R2P does not give any satisfying answer to that question. Again, it is Kant who leads us on this when he deals with the modalities of the just war against the unjust enemy. All nations, says Kant, should unite against the unjust enemy whose conduct affects the interest of all nations, of them all. Those nations united should deprive the culprit of the power to act in a similar way again. However, says Kant, this does not entitle them, that is to say, this coalition of nations opposing the unjust enemy, to divide up the offending state among themselves and to make it disappear, as it were, from the face of the earth. For this will be an injustice against the people who cannot lose their original right to unite in a commonwealth. And in French, it's to form a republic, to found a republic. They can only be made to accept, the people of that state can only be made to accept a new constitution of a nature that is unlikely to encourage these warlike inclinations. Everything is said there. I could stop there, in fact. I will finish, because I'm nearly there. So, but basically, what Kant says here is that there is a limit, a clear limit in a just war. Because what are we talking about? What are we talking about is basically just war theory. Yeah? The R2P is a new version of the just war theory. There is a clear limit which is put to the power of the federal institution, of the federal entity, when it intervenes militarily to stop a violation of the federal covenant. How do you express that in law with the concept of the notion of federal execution? This concept has been, I think, very clearly explained by a French publicist, whose name, I think, is a bit forgotten, whose name is Léon Duguy. He was a French publicist of the first half of the 20th century. He was, in a way, the master of somebody who is much more well-known to us international lawyers, which is Jean Roussel. And Léon Duguy has made a very clear theory of the federation, and in particular of federal execution. What he explained is that the members of the federation, the members of the federation are created, or the institutions of the members of the Federation are created by an act to which the federal entity, the federal government, if you like, has not participated. And this act, which could be, for instance, a local election electing the government of the member of the Federation, this act of election is something that gives its autonomy to the constituent part of the Federation, its autonomy towards the federal government. So the constituency of the Federation, the member of the Federation, has its own autonomy, has its own legitimacy, and thus the relation between the federal level and the constituent level is not one of hierarchy. The federal institutions cannot command to the government of the members. There's no relation of command. But still, the federal institutions have a role to play towards the federal covenant. The federal institutions have to play a role in terms of being the guarantors of the federal covenant. So it means that the federal institutions have a right to control, to exercise a certain kind of control, not command, but a certain kind of control on the institutions of the members of the Federation when the members of the Federation are not fulfilling their obligations towards the federal covenant. Control, explains Dugui, allows the federal entity to substitute itself to the member who failed to implement crucial provisions of the covenant, like the obligation to respect human rights, for instance, which are guaranteed at the level of the Federation. The federal entity will, in other words, execute, that's why it's federal execution, the federal entity will execute the federal obligations in the place of the member of the Federation which has failed to do so. However, to come back to Kant, the member of the Federation keeps its right to constitute itself as a republic. The people retain their rights to self-determination. They still have the right to decide upon their laws and institutions, provided the provisions of the federal covenant are respected. And that's the meaning of the words of Kant, who says the people should not be stripped of their right to unite themselves in a commonwealth. They should only, the only right of the federal institution, in a way, is to impose a constitution at the level of the member of the Federation that would respect the federal covenant. So let me sum up by trying to apply, and conclude, by trying to apply those ideas to existing international institutions. Today's international society is constituted in a federation of free states. And again, I insist, I'm not saying that we have a federation, not that the UN is a federation. I'm not saying that the present state of the world gives us the manifestation of something which is comparable, for instance, to the United States of America. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the world is into a process of constituting a federation. Federation of free states is a dialectic. It's a process. On the one hand, the free states, on the other hand, the federation. This federation has a constitution, which is partly composed of customary rules, general principles of law, and of the United Nations Charter, which sets up both substantial rules and institutional arrangements. Among those institutions are the Security Council, on which I will focus today. And when the Security Council is called to react to genocide, crimes against humanity, or crimes of war, we have to understand that it's not called to act or to react to a failure to protect human life. It is called to react to a serious breach of the constitutional order of the International Federation. Its reaction is one of a guarantor of this constitutional order, And in this case, as a guarantor of human rights of citizens of the Federation, rights which have been grossly violated by these crimes. On this basis, and on the very well-known legal basis that you all know, Article 39 of the Charter, the Security Council can decide, Article 39 and the following, of course, and 42 in particular, can thus decide a military intervention when it is so needed to make cease the trouble and to re-establish the primacy of the federal constitutional order. What the Security Council is thus deciding as a federal body entrusted with an executive power is to substitute the international community to the government of the state in the fulfillment of its federal obligations. The military intervention must stop when the crimes have stopped. Military intervention and the stopping of crimes might involve a change of government when the government leaders themselves are the criminals, which is something that the R2P does not say, but it might happen that not only the government is not able to protect, but is also the one who is persecuting its own people. However, it should be made clear that such a change of government does not impair the right to self-determination of the people. On the contrary, each change of government should lead to a new process of self-determination, allowing the people of this country to establish democratic institutions, which I think have been more or less the practice since then. A last remark. So I'm not only proposing to change things, I'm understanding to also understand what has happened in the past. A last remark. During the phase of control and substitution, the preservation of the right to self-determination also means that the constitutional human rights of the citizens of that country must be enforced and guaranteed by the federal administration, which I think is still a big challenge today. Because it means basically that the federal administration or its representatives in, for instance, the countries which are leading the intervention and which are administrating in a provisory manner the country, those institutions have to be accountable in terms of human rights. I won't say no more. I've already said too much. Only hope I've kept you awakened. I hope I've created some perspectives of new dreams by this model, theoretical framework, which I think might allow us to better understand the past again, and maybe to better conceive the future. But I, of course, let you judge whether it's an appropriate model or not, and I look forward to your comments and discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.